Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Jesse James has long been the darling of myth and legend in film, on television, and in print. So pervasive has been this blitz of misinformation, intended for entertainment purposes, of course, that the real outlaw remains a bit of a mystery. Our guest this week, T.J. Styles, seeks to set the record straight on one aspect of James's life, the influence of the Civil War on his becoming a criminal. Also joining us will be Joyce Lee Malcolm, who offers us her thoughts on the correlation between disarming the public and public safety by looking at the history of such measures in England. But first, Joyce Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on May 20, 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Homestead Act. It granted 160 acres of public land to any citizen over the age of 21 who lived on the land for over 5 years and made improvements to it. An alternative option provided title to the land if the settler paid $1.25 per acre after 6 months. The Homestead Act was part of an economic package that also included subsidies for the building of the first transcontinental railroad. Land claims under the Homestead Act came in at a formidable rate, in large part due to the record levels of immigration from Europe and the lure of the West to many eastern farmers. By the year 1900, 600,000 claims had been made on over 80 million acres of public land.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, new discoveries are shattering the long-held belief that the inhabitants of Mexico's mysterious Teotihuacan, the city of the gods, located about 30 miles north of Mexico City, were a peaceful people who managed to build one of the most populous cities of its time, larger even than Imperial Rome, without having a warlike despot typically associated with such empires. Instead, excavations of several structures conducted by Saburo Sugiyama have uncovered the graves of hundreds of people whose battered bodies indicate that their rulers were as warlike as their contemporaries and successors in Central and South America among the Maya, Incas, and Aztecs. And the source of another popular hoax has been discovered. In 1936, an unsuspecting hiker discovered what many then thought was the brass plate left behind by English explorer Sir Francis Drake when he sheltered just north of San Francisco in 1579. Although the historical records suggest that Drake did actually leave such a plaque behind, what the hiker actually found was the product of a practical joke played by his friends on Professor Herbert Bolton, who for years informed his students of the marker and urged them to search for it. Details of the hoax were spelled out in the February issue of California History in an article by Ed Vonderportent. This is Talking History. Jesse James may have been the product of his times and place, which is to say the Civil War and the state of Missouri. Or so argues T.J. Styles, the author of a recent book on the outlaw. Talking History's Eileen Dugan spoke to Styles recently about his findings.
Perhaps no criminal in American history has become as shrouded in mystery and romance as has Jesse James. A host of films and television shows featuring the character of Jesse James, played by such leading men as Roy Rogers, Audie Murphy, Tyrone Power, and Rob Lowe, demonstrate our acceptance of him as a good guy who happened to rob banks and kill people. But was Jesse James a Western Robin Hood, as we'd like to imagine? Why did he choose the life that he did, and what was the true record of his crimes? With us today to re-examine the life and legacy of this American icon is Mr. T.J. Styles. Mr. Styles is the author of the new biography, Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War. Welcome, Mr. Styles.
Thank you very much. Good to be on the show.
Thank you. What is the popular image that we have of Jesse James?
Well, there's the Jesse James that we know from TV and movies and going back to the 19th century to dime novels is the Western Robin Hood, the man of the frontier who struck back against these impersonal institutions that hung over farmers' lives on the Western frontier, the banks and the railroads, a man who robbed the rich and gave to the poor and only killed in self-defense.
How have historians characterized him?
It's interesting that historians have, by and large, taken their lead from that popular mythology. The classic model for Jesse James was created by the British historian Eric Hobsbawm, who came up with the idea of the social bandit. as a category to describe Jesse James and others like him. And his idea is that the peasantry, farmers who are largely self-sufficient, aren't really very political, but every once in a while a man comes along who rebels against the system in sort of a blind way, striking back at the powers that be, and he becomes popular for that reason. And it's kind of a scholarly version of the Robin Hood idea.
How does your interpretation differ from others?
Well, both the popular Robin Hood image and the scholarly image of the social bandit are wrong for similar reasons. I mean, first of all, I show that Jesse James was a very dark figure, that he was quite ruthless. Most of his victims, murder victims, were unarmed and helpless when he shot them, though he was involved in many gunfights and whatnot. But more important than that, he was a highly articulate and highly political figure. And rather than the product of an apolitical peasant society that Hobsbawm imagines, or of sort of unpolitical farmers who resent the railroads and banks like popular mythology would have it, he in fact was the product of a very political, very sophisticated society, highly integrated into the market economy, and that it wasn't economic resentments, but Civil War loyalties and Reconstruction political issues that shaped his view and the view of his supporters and enemies.
Going back to the context of Jesse James and before the Civil War, what would he have seen growing up in Missouri as a young man?
Well, that's something that I devote a fair amount of attention to in my book. The typical book about Jesse James sort of rushes to the good parts, the robberies and escapes and escapades of his bandit career. But I stop and look at Missouri, Western Missouri, before the Civil War, a society that was very dependent upon slavery. Jesse James's family owned 6 to 7 slaves before the Civil War. They comprised the majority of the population on his family farm, and they comprised the better part of the family's wealth also. It was a society that was heavily torn, though, by the issue of slavery, because in the 1850s, when a border war began in the Kansas Territory, pro-slavery Missouri border ruffians began to terrorize anti-slavery Kansas settlers who formed their own militias to fight back. There was a terrible division within Missouri itself over how far to go to protect slavery, so that even in Jesse James's community, people began to divide over the issue of slavery, even if they were both pro-slavery. And Jesse James's family was very hard-line. They were very much in favor of Southern independence if necessary. And so when the Civil War broke out, they took the side of the South immediately, whereas many of their neighbors, through this long division, this turmoil, this violence that had been taking place in their community, decided to side for the Union. So Jesse James grew up in a society that was very much torn by the great issues of the day, right down to the grassroots, a border state where people had to make personal political choices about these issues. And in terms of his family life, there, too, he'd gone through quite a bit of turmoil. His father had died in the California Gold Rush in 1850, and his mother, as a widow in a society where there were few rights for women, property rights especially, as well as civil and political rights, she had to struggle to keep control of her property, and there were many years of turmoil before she finally remarried in a stable marriage.
How did James go through the process of what you call violentization during the Civil War?
Well, again, it comes down to a matter of how badly divided this border state society was. Where the Civil War was a matter of the clash of great armies elsewhere, in Missouri, neighbors formed military organizations for the Confederacy or for the Union. Unionists formed militia groups. Confederates formed guerrilla groups called bushwhackers, and Jesse James joined the bushwhackers at the age of 16. His brother had joined, older brother Frank had joined a year before that. And many of their actions were not military clashes of the classic type, but rather a matter of political cleansing. The first guerrilla organization that Jesse belonged to acted as a death squad, going from house to house, killing Unionist men on their front porches. So this process of what sociologist Lonnie Athens calls violentization, a man immersed in violence, taught that extreme violence as a matter of winning respect, a way of winning a sense of power in a very turbulent society, in a very turbulent conditions. Jesse James made a political, personal choice. He wasn't just a victim. He wasn't just hurled into this life of violence. But once it began, he went through his adolescence immersed in the worst kind of violence, killing neighbors, dismembering the dead, shooting prisoners, truly shocking atrocities.
In the prologue of your book, in fact, you suggest that had Jesse James existed a century later, he would have been called a terrorist. That seems a rather strong statement at first, but how do you explain that?
Well, I'm careful to say also in the prologue that he can't be compared to, say, the Red Brigades or Osama bin Laden. There's a very well-developed kind of political terrorism that we're familiar with in the 20th and 21st centuries. However, if you think of terrorism as the use of violence and the gaining of notoriety and attention through violence to advance a political cause, which is a fairly common sense definition of terrorism, Jesse James definitely fits that definition. During the Civil War, the guerrillas that he fought with served as, very terroristic fighters. Even though they were definitely military guerrillas, they were also terrorizing the Unionist population. Afterwards, he was using the notoriety he gained from his robberies to advance the cause of former Confederates in politics, writing letters to the press, occasionally making political statements during robberies, and he continued to fight against the Union victory and the Reconstruction policies of the federal government, using his notoriety for that effect.
What was the state of Missouri and of his family as well after the Civil War?
Well, that grassroots division that first began before the war and then just completely tore apart Missouri society during the Civil War left the state shattered. 1 million people approximately lived in Missouri before the Civil War. In 1865, 300,000 people were missing. Now, many of them returned, certainly not all of them were killed. However, that statistic, roughly 1 out of 3 people fleeing, being driven out or being killed in the state by the end of the war, shows how badly divided the society was. And what happened is that the state divided in 3 ways. You had secessionists, you had conservative unionists who basically wanted to preserve the Union and the old slaveholding society as it was, and then you had radical unionists who became the Republican Party, who decided that you had to overthrow the old society to make a new society to preserve the Union. They became emancipationists, abolitionists, began to advocate for black civil rights at the end of the war. Jesse James found a political role to play on this 3-way division, because the conservative unionists and the Confederates both became part of the Democratic Party, and it was in that 3-way division that he emerged as a hero to Confederates as they tried to rise to predominance within the Democratic Party.
Why did he seek being a hero, though, by robbing banks? What did he hope to gain out of that?
Well, first of all, one thing I note is that he was definitely a criminal, and there's no doubt that he and his fellow outlaws were in it for the money, that there were men who had been raised, who'd gone in a life of violence, who had gone through this process of violentization. But their transition from guerrilla to bandit began amid intense political turmoil at the end of the Civil War in Missouri, so that 1866, the year of a climactic congressional election that shaped the Reconstruction policies in Washington, led to immense turmoil within Missouri itself. There was violence between rival political groups, and the Confederate guerrillas that Jesse rode with launched the first daylight peacetime bank robbery in American history of a bank that was specifically affiliated with the radical Republicans in the county seat of Jesse James's home county. And the men who owned the bank and ran it were all the local radical Republican officials, the most hard line of unionists, the most extreme enemies of the Confederate guerrillas. They robbed the bank 2 weeks after the first Republican rally in the county's history. And that began a year-long confrontation with the state authorities by this group of guerrillas that Jesse belonged to. Now, later on, the political turmoil died down. However, Jesse James emerged as the leader of this group, or at least the spokesman, because he continued to explicitly tie the bandits to politics, saying that he was a victim of radical Republicans and he had no choice but to fight back and to stay outside the law in order to preserve his life. Now, many of the robberies they carried on later on were not so symbolic as that very first one, but some of them were. Often they struck banks that were specifically affiliated with their political enemies.
You've mentioned already how Jesse James would sometimes make statements to the press, and here we get to the story of John Newman Edwards. What was the relationship between them, and why did Edwards want to tell his story?
Well, John Newman Edwards has long been known to have been a key figure in the story of Jesse James. He was a newspaper editor who founded the Kansas City Times in 1868. He had been a Confederate cavalryman in the regular Confederate Army, and he was so hard-lined a Confederate that he refused to surrender at the end of the Civil War and went into exile in Mexico for 2 years. When he returned, he began to use his newspapers to promote the cause of Confederates, both culturally, to try to make Missouri more of a southern state, to build a Confederate consciousness there, and also politically, to try to bring Confederates back into politics and then bring them to dominance within the Democratic Party. Now, for 5 years after the Civil War, Confederates were not allowed to vote in Missouri because of the Constitution written by the Radical Republicans. After 5 years of in exile, however, the Confederates were allowed to vote, and they began to fight to become the leading political element. Now, John Newman Edwards wrote editorials that praised Jesse James, starting just at the time when this transition, the Confederate return to politics, began, and just at the time when Jesse James himself emerged as the leading bandit among these outlaws who had been Confederate guerrillas. And the two of them worked together. John Newman Edwards would write editorials praising the robberies, yet saying Jesse James himself is innocent and he was being targeted by the radical Republicans who wouldn't leave him alone. Jesse James himself would write letters to the newspapers saying, I don't care whether the radicals think I'm guilty or not, however, I'm innocent, but they haven't left me alone since the end of the war. And what happened is that they created a martyr hero, someone that Confederates could be proud of, a man who was a great fighter and never laid down his arms, yet also a symbol of how the radical Republicans had persecuted them after the war in their eyes. And he also helped win sympathy for the Confederate viewpoint among conservative Unionist Democrats. And the sort of consciousness of the state of Missouri became more Southern through the life of Jesse James than it actually had been before the war itself, when people were very divided about whether it was a northern or a southern state.
We only have a few moments left, but perhaps you could we could wrap this up by discussing why it is that we remain fascinated by Jesse James. I mean, do you believe his story has any relevance to us today?
Well, I think that it does have great relevance. I think on one hand, we still are fascinated with Jesse James because of what he has symbolized in popular culture, the idea of the rebel who stands against society, who defies the impersonal forces which overshadow all of our lives. However, the real Jesse James that I look at, the historical Jesse James, is extremely relevant because he shows how the most peaceful, well-developed society can degenerate into shocking violence, and how that violence can be praised and accepted by otherwise peaceful, law-abiding people. Jesse James committed horrible crimes. He was fiercely denounced by most Missourians, but there were people who were still so bitter over the Civil War in that state that they praised Jesse James and they admired him because they thought he was guilty, because they thought that here was a man who was fighting the good cause. And the good cause to them was an opposition to civil rights, an opposition to the Union victory, in opposition to all the egalitarian values that had emerged out of the end of the Civil War. And the degree to which people can embrace violence is one of the dark lessons that comes out of the life of Jesse James, a man who was able to galvanize resentments through violence. And it happened in the heart of the United States.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Stiles.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Mr. T.J. Stiles, author of the new biography, Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger. is no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I'm going there to see my Father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm just a going over Jordan. I'm just a going over
home. Continuing on our discussion of the influence of Jesse James' life in Missouri on his career as an outlaw, we've chosen for our site of the week his home in St. Joseph, Missouri. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
Sitting on a small bluff by the roadside, the Jesse James home in St. Joseph, Missouri, offers visitors the chance to see where the outlaw lived with his family and the room where Bob Ford shot him. There, among the memorabilia, you can see a post-mortem photograph of James showing the wound over his left eye and artifacts from his grave, which were exhumed in 1995 for DNA testing, and a casting of his skull showing the bullet's trajectory. The tiny living room seems an unlikely scene for a murder, but it was here that Jesse stood on a chair to straighten a crooked pitcher, allowing Bob Ford the perfect opportunity to shoot him in the back of the head. You can see the bullet hole in the wall, enlarged over the years by the scraping of souvenir hunters' penknives. The James home is owned and operated by the Pony Express Historical Association, which also owns the nearby Patty House Museum, headquarters for the Pony Express in 1860. For more information, visit www.stjoseph.net/Pony Express/.
And finally, also on a related subject, we turn to the much-debated question of whether there is any correlation between the possession of guns and violence. Although little consensus has been reached, much has been written on guns and violence in the United States. Joyce Lee Malcolm decided to test the hypothesis in England, and she joins us this week to tell us what she found.
At the core of the gun controversy is the issue of whether disarming the public leads to a safer society. For 80 years, the safety of the English people has been staked on the premise that fewer guns means less crime, indeed that any weapons in the hands of men and women, however law-abiding, pose a danger. Britons have been assured they don't need to protect themselves. Society will protect them. English gun restrictions, now the toughest of any democracy, are often credited with producing low rates of violent crime. But have they? Has strict gun regulations and general disarmament led to a safer community? The historical evidence fails to support that claim. My book, Guns and Violence, The English Experience, points out that violent crime in England had been declining for 400 years before 1920, when the first gun restrictions were imposed. And when guns were freely available, gun crime was astonishingly low. A government study for the years 1890 through 1892 found only 3 handgun homicides, an average of 1 a year in a population of 30 million. In 1904, there were only 4 armed robberies in London, then the largest city in the world. But if gun regulations made England safer? After declining for centuries, violent crime began spiraling upward in the 1950s and has been generally rising ever since. Despite increasingly restrictive gun legislation, despite a 1997 ban on handguns, and a 1953 act prohibiting carrying any article for personal protection. Common law regarded self-defense as the first among an individual's rights, yet along with gun regulations has come a policy that discourages self-defense. Using force against a mugger can lead to charges of assault, or the mugger can sue. A man who used a toy gun to detain two burglars who broke into his home, was arrested by the police for putting the burglars in fear with a toy gun. An elderly lady who chased off a gang of youths with a cap pistol was arrested on the same charge. People who see someone being attacked are advised to walk on by and leave the matter to the professionals. But no police force, however large, can protect everyone, and the British government's insistence on a monopoly of force has come at a high price. By 2002, violent crime in England exceeded that of 17 other industrial countries, including the United States. As for the impact of gun restrictions, in the 2 years after the 1997 handgun ban, handgun crime rose by 40%. Last year, gun crime rose another 35%, and for the first time, English police are armed. History shows that guns in and of themselves were not a cause or cure for crime in England. When guns were unrestricted, violent crime was low, while gun bans have failed to stop or even slow gun violence. Public safety was not enhanced by depriving people of reasonable means for personal safety.
You've been listening to Joyce Lee Malcolm, professor of history at Bentley College and the author of Guns and Violence, The English Experience, and To Keep and Bear Arms, The Origins of an Anglo-American Right. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We welcome your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. You can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.